Thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 213. This week sees since Anthony take the reins once again, and he does a full introduction so that I don't have to. He's joined by Neil Morkin Jr. So suffice to say, this is me, Harry Brady, and this is him, St. Anthony, with him, Neil Morkin. Enjoy.
Welcome to another Celtic Underground podcast with me, St. Anthony. I'm delighted to have the opportunity tonight to be able to talk to a man with a famous Celtic name, Neil Morkin. Neil is the son of the legendary Celtic player and trainer Neil Morkin, a member of Jock Stein's backroom staff from the legendary Lisbon era, who was a tremendous servant to Celtic for close on 40 years. We're going to have a wee chat about Neil Senior and discuss a new book about his life, which is in the pipeline. But firstly, Neil, can we start with the normal traditional opening question? Who was your first Celtic hero and what was your first Celtic game you can recall?
Well, see, I thought about this. See, I didn't really have heroes because, fortunately enough, I was growing up with these guys, but I was working with these guys who played for Celtic. So a hero probably wouldn't be the right word. But the earliest memory of somebody who I thought was good for us, probably Ronnie Glavin, believe it or not. I know Doug Leash played at the same time as well, but for some reason, Ronnie Glavin stuck in my mind. Another player I remember, a young sticking it because he was a bit different, would be Big Shuggy, his Bilson. So that would be my earliest kind of memory of people who stuck in my mind. Wee Jimmy, obviously, with the red hair. I got the tail end of his career. So I wouldn't say hero's the right word, but they're the ones that I sort of remembered.
Ed Wilson would have been a bit exotic then, wouldn't he?
But he was different.
First of the foreign influx.
In foreigner. In the changing room, you think that was well different. Because you're used to, obviously, predominantly Scottish boys.
So what first game then? What's the first game in your mind that you can actually have a recollection of watching or seeing?
Well, I couldn't tell you what it was, what the score was, but Aberdeen, probably because of the red strips. Mm-hmm. And I remember wee Jimmy on the wing. But that was for a very young age. That's what I remember being, them playing in all red, and wee Jimmy red hair on the wing. And to me, as a wee boy, that was good. He was a wee man on the wing there.
And going to Celtic Park at the time, with a wee chat earlier, and you were saying that you'd run to the place when you were a boy.
Well, why?
Must have been a great experience.
Well, it wasn't an experience at the time, it was just the norm. See, that again, I don't know how to put it, but it was just like going to my auntie's house. No, I walked around, everybody knew me, and I had basically run to the place, but nobody batted an eyelid at me. So. And you've got to remember that back then, I mean, there's maybe, I don't know how many works pupils in that place now, maybe 300. Might be employed through there now. Mm. At that time, you're talking probably staff-wise, less than 20. Mm-hmm. So I was always Neely's boy. I was never Neely. I think I was addressed as Neely. I was always referred to as Neely's boy. You see Neely's boy, there's Neely's boy there. Talk to Neely's boy.
Did the players make a wee fussy at that point? Because you were a boy, did the players
make a wee fussy? Well, they would do with anybody's kids, I guess, would come in. So I was probably, there wasn't many actually kicked around after the game because I was, as a youngster, I used to get taken through with one of my mum and dad's next door neighbours. She used to take us through, and for the first maybe 5-6 years, she would take me home until I was about 10. What would happen, she would take me through, then I would stay and my dad would bring us home. Mm-hmm. Because my dad never had a licence, a driving licence until he was pretty old. Mm-hmm. It was quite a while. In fact, I'm pretty sure he didn't actually pass a test. I think it's been Wembley tickets he's got him, his driving licence. But it was late on, he was pretty old when he got his licence, and then I used to come back with him. Then when I got to 17, pass my test, I would go through, then drive him home and let him have a drink after the game.
Mm-hmm. Now, your dad had a notable career, not only with Celtic, but then, I mean, my father-in-law, for example, is Greenock born and bred, and he still refers to your dad as a cannonball kid, because he'd have been young in the days, and he remembers going to Capello, and he says, what a great player your dad was, and how, as a Celtic fan, he was delighted that when he came to Celtic in later years. So he's went from, he also had a notable spell at Middlesbrough.
I think Morton got decent money for him at the time. I think maybe 12, 14 grand at that time would be decent money.
A lot
money.
Of money, yeah, indeed.
So it was at Morton for, I don't know, I guess 6 years. I didn't realise it was quite as long. So it was maybe about 6 years. Went down to Middlesbrough. He was there possibly 2 seasons, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Then Celtic brought him back up for 8 or 10 grand, I think it was. Which is still decent money then. But I come up and that was 53.
And your dad's no longer in the door. And he's it's a famous quiz question. Who was a Celtic player? Won 2 winners medals before he played a game at Celtic Park.
Charity Shield, Glasgow
Charity Cup.
Scored 2 against Clyde, would have been right. Possibly they won that cup. Then the next game week was the beginning of the Coronation Cup. He played Man United, played Arsenal, played Hibs in the final. Mm-hmm. And he scored, I think, against Man United, then he scored, obviously, in the final.
Mm-hmm. Now, but we can't let that go with it. Describing the goal, because it's one of the iconic goals in Celtic's history. And my dad used to take me to Hampden when I was a boy, and he used to take me at a railing that separated the enclosure for the Celtic end, and he would find a particular spot in the railing and he would say he was hanging in that railing in 1953 trying to get a better view when your dad hit above it, estimated 35 yards.
Well,
and it was still moving, apparently. nearly took the net out.
I felt, if there was 90,000 in that game, I've spoke to 85,000 of them over the years, because when I was a laddie, that's always the first thing that says to me. Obviously, when I was talking about 1970, so maybe you're only maybe 18 years after the event. So everybody who found out I was Neely's boy, that was the first thing. And they'd all tell me where it was from and how it hit. But what my dad used to laugh at, he says, I hit it fair distance and hit it hard. He says, but that was my wrong foot. Because he was left-footed, obviously, but he hit it with his right foot.
Do you never knew that was a right foot?
Is it a right footer?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, I've seen a goal just recently in the Madrid derby. I don't know, you might have seen it. Boy hit one for Atletico. Mm-hmm. And going by all the accounts I've heard, it sounds very similar to that. The boy took a ball for the left half position, or whatever, you cut inside, and nobody's approached him, and he's white one for distance. Mm-hmm. That, and I mind, as soon as I went, I thought, you know something, that sounds or looks to me, all the accounts I've heard, my dad's goal in that game, it sounds, that looks pretty much.
The thing that people don't appreciate is Hibs were overwhelming favourites to win that day. They made the famous five. And for what what I've been told by certain people at the time, that goal looked at the heart of Hibs, because it was such an outstanding goal. It was one of the goals that won in a million.
Possibly. I'm obviously wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you. But it was, like I say, I'll go back again, the amount of people that says to me, once they found out who I was, that was the first thing anybody would say to me as a kid. Yeah. It's worn off a bit now.
And when it gets to 1954, he's one of the first Celtic players ever to play in the World Cup finals.
That's 54, that's right, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
Switzerland, but I think there's only 14 of them went across, actually. I've got a photograph kicking about, actually, I just found recently, and it was the boys that went, and I think there's 14 of them, and by all accounts, ill prepared is a bit of the best. Yeah, they had the woolen jumpers and in the heat. Yeah, all Switzerland in the summer. That's, I believe, right. It was 80 odd degrees in that particular. But there you go. He's played in the World Cup. They took a hell of a beat.
Uruguay.
No, I don't think Scotland scored. Little my dad scored. I did see footage actually of the Uruguay game. Somebody showed me a while back, and it was an attempt. He had the goalkeeper saved it, but. I don't know if we even scored.
Mm.
I'm not sure. It might be 7-1 with Uruguay. Mm. We will beat the French, possibly.
France, that's right.
And one other team, no matter. So
typical Scotland. So as time passes on a wee bit, we get to 1957, and there's the iconic 7-1 game. And I know that the footage at the time went missing, but fortunately since then we've managed to get a hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it, and we see your dad dribbling along the byline and hitting the rocket shot straight under the crossbar.
Uh-huh.
And he ripped Shearer apart that day.
That's what Sean used to always refer to.
A notable opponent, Bobby Shearer. Captain Cutlass, they used to call
him. Sean Fallon used to say that to me. He says that Shearer was, your dad on Shearer that day.
Mm-hmm.
Says that was, he reckoned that was the biggest, what would you say, that? Biggest plus, or maybe not the biggest reason, but he says the fact Shearer was
advantage.
My dad got the better of Shearer that day.
Uh-huh.
it meant steel with steel, as they said.
Because the thing about your dad being a good football player as well, but by all accounts, what I can gather, he was a hardy wee guy.
Aye, well, that's what Sean says. He says a couple of times that might have been his thing, not to done the whoever he's up against him early. Mm-hmm. But I think my dad done him, not he reversed it, not retaliated first. And well, I think a couple of times Sean says he met his match that day.
I read about one time about Shearer, and he was recollecting the 7-1 game, and he said he had his medal and he threw it away, and he was moving house years later, and he took out his three-piece suite, and he looked down the back of the three-piece suite, like, you know, as you do when you maybe move the cushions and stuff, and there's his medal lying there, and he went off his head because he thought that he didn't want to see it, he didn't want to be reminded about it in any shape or form. So, but I think, again, from hearing from my dad at the time, that there was so many of that Celtic team maybe played their best game that day. I mean, Willie Fernie apparently was totally outstanding. Mm-hmm. Bobby Evans was dominant in the midfield. Billy McPhail ran him up with
Valentine. Legendary, I mean, names in there, but the ones a little, it's a strange one. They had brilliant players, but for that there was a period went by that they weren't very successful. I mean, the League and Cup double, 53-54, they got, but then your 7-1 game. Mm-hmm.
And then it was a dearth until Big Joke came back.
That's right, yeah.
So that would bring us on to your dad was brought back as a trainer in, I think it was 1964.
64, yeah.
But it surprised me because I was always under the misapprehension that Joke Steenbutt would have brought your dad in, but he was already there.
No, Sean had brought him in. And early years when I was older, he was saying, how'd that come out? He says, oh, it's my pal. That's exactly what he says, my pal. He says, so why'd you bring my dad? No, it's my pal. He says, me and him got on great. He said, I brought him back, and obviously Steen coming next game. He would have been, Steen would have got tipped off. He knew he was coming, and he was quite happy.
Yeah,
he was delighted, because my dad played with Steen.
That's right.
In fact, Steen called the Coronation Cup. He didn't call it the Coronation, but he called it the Morton Cup. Mm. That was always his wee thing with that. Where's that Morton Cup? What, they moved the Morton Cup. So Steen was coming, knew Sean, knew my dad, and so everything was going to go there.
So Steen comes in and it's the start of the great days, and
it was the start of the great days because I was born a week later.
Was it? Or was it the really great days?
So that's not my birthday. It was March.
65. And so there'd been a big event for your dad, Mary Wise, in London, because not only is Jock Steen arriving soon, but you come as well.
That's right.
So these are the great days, and for those of us who were brought up in the years of the nine in a row, my recollection of looking at the Celtic bench was Jock Steen, Sean Fallon, your dad, Bob Rooney and Jimmy Steele.
That's right, yeah.
And I made a point to Paul Dykes recently when we did a podcast about the Quality Street guy. My dad used to say to me, he used to point to the bench and say, see the guys there, there's nobody in British football with more knowledge of the game. The only ones comparable at the time is probably the Anfield, where Shankly had a similar setup.
That's right. Well, that's what I think a few of them do. I don't know this, but I think Ferguson looked at what they had there, and when he went to heat, that's what he tried to recreate. No, that where they had these three, four guys that run about them, where they were tight, really tight.
Confidence.
You really had to be tight, because... Yeah. I would be sometimes down in the boot room after the game, and obviously I was always there. Well, not always, but the majority of the time I was there. So they were comfortable with me being a bit there. But I would notice they could be having a wee chat to carry on, and this one would be getting called this, and that one would be getting called. The home truth's getting told. But as soon as anybody, even first teamers, appeared, the conversation would change.
The guard would come up.
Obviously there was one or two the first teams eventually would be trusted to the point. But it was notable whenever we're talking and anybody happened to wander by, they could be sitting in the foyer and two of them could be talking, Sheena could be talking, and anybody would wander around, it was noticeable that their tone changed, and it was all kind of PC for then on. So why?
But then I think you're right there, the fact that Jock Steen trusted these guys implicitly.
Absolutely.
It was guys that he'd played with, guys he knew intimately, and there was a bond there. He, even as a fan, as a boy, you could tell there was a bond between them.
Well, because, I mean, they would play players off, not good guy, good cop, bad cop. I mean, that would happen as well. So, I mean, they would set situations up to happen. No, it wasn't the accident. They might look like it was an accident, but they would set things up. Wasn't unintentional.
So 1965, Celtic won the League Cup, and unfortunately there was a pitch invasion that day, And again, I'm going from what my dad told me, that a couple of the Celtic players were getting attacked, and it was your dad that came to the rescue.
There's been a couple of occasions.
Apparently, I lumped a couple.
Well, allegedly, I know. I think the Atletico game, is that? That's another one. I think it's fair to say he was involved in. Because I don't know, you ever been in the tunnel, even the old tunnel? But the tunnel's it's not exactly the same
much.
But there is a bit you have to go through that's very narrow. Mm. It's always been very narrow. So I think there was fisticuffs in there, and by all accounts he was involved. That particular game you're talking about, there's a photograph I've seen. He's got a guy with a neck, he's actually pulling him. But to what happened before or after that, I'm not sure. But allegedly, yeah.
So for anybody that doesn't know the script here, Laps Honour get banned at Hampden for a number of years.
That's right, yeah.
And it just happened to coincide when we hit the golden spell. And you would win the cup, and the players were even deprived of a lap of honour because of these rampaging Huns running about Hampden. So we can't talk about Neil Malkin and no mention Lisbon. When you grew up a wee bit, did they have any recollection of Lisbon that particularly stands out?
No, he always laughed. In fact, Jim Craig tells a good story about my dad. The night before games, my dad used to take them a walk, and I was just like, I'll loosen up the exercise. But in Lisbon, by all accounts in Lisbon, they ended up, they got lost, and climbing their fences, 8-foot fences, drunk their walls.
And
in the dark. This is before, I mean, anything. My dad's obviously saying, there's a hotel there, they're not, I was coming, by all accounts, it was in the salt course. And the night before the European Cup final, so he laughed at it. I used to laugh at that.
But you know, in some mad way, that might have relaxed him.
Of course, well, that was the whole point. I don't think they're supposed to be jumping their walls.
No, but they would have got a laugh out of that.
Aye, exactly.
And a wee bit of lighthearted before a big game.
Aye, laughing.
And your dad at the time, my recollection is he had a brilliant, distinctive green tracksuit with a big letters in the back, Celtic FC.
For the game, aye.
For the game, and Bob Rooney also did something similar.
I think I used that to paint the fence one year, actually, believe it or not.
You did?
I thought, when I was, you've got to remember, as a 14-year-old, you just pick up, what have I got, that'll do, I'll take that. And I'm sure I did use that.
We'll go into that.
In fact, I'll say painting a creosote, actually. It was creosote.
We'll come on to that later, because you've got a wonderful collection of your dad's stuff here, which is like an Aladdin's cave. We'll move on to that a wee bit later. The other thing as well that the recollection I used to have was he had a towel around his neck at all times.
Right,
he always seemed to wrap a towel around him, you know, a boxing. You know, the guy gets a second in the boxing camp in the corner man.
Well, that's served two purposes, because it kept his neck warm first and foremost. But then when he was going to treat players, the towel was going to
help.
So it was there. So rather than carry it, he thought, in fact, I've seen a couple of images of him running. He runs around that park and he's got the towel. Tangling behind. That was a practical thing. He needed it.
Yeah,
he needed
to
go in the park, basically.
Yeah. And he had the nickname Smiler Ball. Where did that come from?
I've heard it said, I read it one time in an old something that one boy's alluding to, was because he was doer. You ask anybody who knew what that was, wasn't it? Because he was doer. They don't laugh most of the time. And again, people who I meet now, for years ago, first things, your dad's laugh, because he had a high pitch. And scarily enough, I do it myself sometimes now, but it's just, I don't know where that comes from.
We're sitting here now, and I'm not being facetious in any way, but you bear a remarkable resemblance to your dad as a young man.
As a young man, thanks very much.
I mean, you talk about the smile and the rest of the stuff, it's uncanny looking like a young Neil Malkin from maybe like the Lisbon days.
Oh, that's good. What age would you have been then? I'll accept that. Thanks very much.
I mean, it's a compliment. As I said, he was so trusted by Jockstein and Sean Fallon and were they close socially?
Not socially. My dad wasn't really a dogs was my dad's thing.
Graham.
for a social event. I mean, he would have joked about the house for it, and maybe Sean would be through, but no socially. They certainly wouldn't be where we're going out for a pint this week. My dad hardly drank until, like I say, probably when I passed my driving test. That's when he would be sitting, when he used to go into the boot room, or be the physio room, they'd sit and chat about the game. My dad would maybe take a half inch of whiskey and 5 inches of lemonade. That was really the first recollection ever on the drink. So no, he wasn't really a social going out to pubs, apart from maybe Celtic tours. No, we would invariably get invited to a lot of them, so we'd go to them, but again, he wasn't really a drinker at them, that I can remember. No, it was Doug's was his thing. He used to go to Falkirk, Armadale, Shawfield.
For somebody like myself, I find it hard to comprehend having my father, who was such a high-ranking job at Celtic at the time, for a team we all love. But me and you have discussed this previously, and I'm saying my dad would come home and he would talk about the day he had and that kind of thing. But it must have been weird to sit there and hear something that affects our whole lives and something that we love so much. But you say the way you describe it is it was just a job.
He just come back for his work. I mean, he wouldn't sit and talk about what had happened. When we're coming back in the car, obviously we'd have a chat. That was probably the best time. Because it's right after the game and everything's fresh in the memory and what have you. But he wouldn't come back daily and say, oh, we've done this at training, we've done that at training. It wasn't really, I mean, you've got to remember that I'm a young boy. I'm only a 7-year-old up to 13, or what do you say, a 17, 13-year-old. It's only when I'm getting 14, 15 that I'm even appreciating maybe what we're watching. And then appreciating what's happened maybe only just maybe 10 years before, no? But I think, because it seemed that long, where Lisbon seemed that long when I was just finishing school, it seemed like it was forever, but it's not really. I mean, you're only talking 13, 14, 15 years.
I mean, I'm the same. I was born in 66, and my first recollections is looking at books, and you would see the European Cup, and you would know it was Billy McNeil, and he would just take it for granted, almost. Oh, that was that year we won that European Cup.
Sorry.
It was pretty blasé. And it's only when you get older as a teenager and you've seen other teams winning, and you thought, what an achievement that was.
I know, exactly. And it's the same, again, I was in a very privileged position where you never really thought about it. And I would, when my dad and them were talking, I'd maybe wander into the boardroom. Every bit of silverware history, they used to all be sitting around. I used to use a bit of goalposts. I used to get a ball and kick the ball about.
Did you get to play in the pitch?
The door that went into the out to the park used to get shut up. Really major after the game when they were sweeping the when you got to remember the terraces used to get
swept.
So I would go out there and I remember taking a ball. I'd actually kick a ball more than the mouth of the tunnel. That was probably where I used to go out and kick a ball about sometimes. But like I say, once that door got shut over, I couldn't get out. I just might find myself in the boardroom or just wander around in drawers. I used to have a look in drawers. I said, here, and probably important information. But I used to, as a young boy, I mean, I'm not talking I wasn't being dozy. I was only a young, between the ages of like 7 and 12 year old.
You're making a good point, actually, because you touched on the thing there that Celtic might at that time only have 20 employees within the club. And you know, I remember getting a tour of the stadium.
I mean, non-playing, that's what I'm saying. Not so much players, obviously, you get the players, would be more, but there wasn't an awful lot of non-playing.
No, that's what I'm talking about, employees, if you like, non-playing staff. Guys in the
other. Prezi used to do the tickets
and the women in the
no,
that kind of thing, you've the groundsman and maybe that kind of thing.
Yeah, the wee woman, was it Susan?
And John McAlinden, maybe an electrician.
John McAlinden, and they used to, the wee woman who used to do the pies and the tea and that, and the. Underneath full time and that, so there wasn't a lot.
So what I'm trying to relay here is that the fact that I remember getting a tour of the old stadium before the new front got put on in the centenary, and you know, I was actually shocked at how small the space
was
inside.
People used to say to me, what do you do inside?
That's right.
Well, there's not really, you've got a boardroom.
There was a presidential room, I think. President Kennedy's photo.
That's right. That became, they moved the boardroom. Boardroom used to be at the front just as you come in the right. Then they moved that into what you're calling the presidential room. So things got moved around, but essentially it wasn't a huge area. People would have been really surprised. People were really surprised anytime we took people in.
In comparison to the stadium these days, when you go for a tour and you get shown the suites and you get shown the big huge trophy room we've got now, and even the dressing rooms are massive.
The media room.
Room and the skybox, that kind of thing. I mean, there was nothing.
Or a golf.
You're there for a couple of hours going round there.
But no, not then. You literally had changing rooms, home changing rooms, away changing rooms, the physio room, boot room. The boardroom, I mean, people went, I think people got taken in there. By then, like I say, whenever I was away, I could go wherever I wanted. In fact, me and my dad used to lock the place up, not the big green doors.
Aye, the main doors.
Literally, we believe in there, quarter to seven, seven something at the time that everything was closed. But when he pulled that door shut, one key,
that was it
locked till Monday morning. Mm-hmm. Usually, that's a Saturday.
But
night.
These days, are the security men in the premises.
Well, exactly, there's people in there. I think so. That's quarter to seven. Well, sometimes half six. We're going to 7 o'clock. Might as well leave at half six for whatever reason. Holiday obligations, whatever, maybe half six, but it's usually maybe quarter seven, and that would be that locked over. Mm-hmm. Normally till Monday morning when my dad come in with a key, one the single key, and that was the whole stadium locked. Yeah. So mm-hmm. It's changed days, 100%. For the better, I would say. Well, in some aspects.
Well, we've grown. Unfortunately,
you have to be, it's much a business now rather than a bit. Uh-huh. We're still a club, but it's a big business. Uh-huh. It is a big business now.
But I know we were talking about this earlier as well, it's a point I always make, is that the players and guys like your dad and Sean Fallon, Jock Stein, were more approachable then, they were more touchable.
Absolutely. Well, they walked in and out the front door on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, now they go up to Lennox Town. It's disconnecting them, no? I mean, mm-hmm. and there's more foreigners. I mean, but it's just the way it's went. It's unfortunate, but that's just the way it's went.
There's a brilliant photo in the Kerry Dale Street site that I'm sure you've seen. And it's John Hughes, the main guy, and he's passing by the Springfield Vaults in London.
That's
Road.
That's right.
Walking to training with Sarah.
The old woman with the messages.
The old woman with the messages and the scarf and he'd coming back and his all green, white and gold bus going right. Bayless.
Well, they used to stop at the cafe on the lights. There used to be what did they call it now? Basically, you'd go and get a rolling sausage or a pie or something. Mm-hmm. Coming back for training. That's what they would wander in.
But it shows you how ordinary they were, that they would just walk to training, there was no airs and graces. Sorry. And they were very much part of the even part of the community in the area.
That's right.
If you stayed in London Road, you would have been aware of the fact that there's a Celtic team going to train.
That's right.
So you would have that's a fantastic photograph. Just behind him, there's the likes of wee Jinky and Bobby Lennox and Molly O'Neill, and they've all got wee gangs and wee cliques. But Big John's the main guy you see with the big baseball boots marching to training.
In fairness, you couldn't imagine trying to do that now. No. Couldn't it be done now?
Times have changed.
Actually, change has changed. It's had to go forward, and us, I guess.
So as time passed on, Jock Stein eventually left in 1978, but it's a great tribute to your dad that managers came and went and retained his services at the same time.
Well, it was Big Billy came in, and obviously, he's no long finished playing, was he? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how long, he'd only been away, 3 years, mm-hmm. possibly 4 years. So,
3 years.
And he was up in Aberdeen, so it was quite smooth, it was pretty smooth. I don't know the politics of the big man getting his jaws. I mean, that's mm-hmm. something different, because again, I'm just a young boy then. I'm not any great age at all. So to me, it was just, all right, Big Joke's leaving. Well, that's quite odd. I knew it was odd, and you'd hear him talking, but I had to just accept it as being a young boy. Then Big Billy was in, and off we went again.
Mm-hmm.
It was relatively smooth from my point of view and from my dad's point of view. There was no upheaval because everybody knew everybody.
It's a tribute to your dad that he was an integral part of the club at the time, that they wanted to retain his services.
Well, that would have been... who would have made that decision? Probably been Billy, I guess.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Then there's Davey Hay. Because anybody come in, who'd be the first one that would have known? Probably Liam Brady. Would he have been the first manager that would have known my dad? But Liam Brady, he held my dad very high. I know he did. Mm-hmm. He liked my dad, Liam Brady. Because before Brady, I'm on the theory, was it?
Brady was Lou
McCarry, but even Lou McCarry knew my dad FaceTime mm-hmm. up there, so that's maybe right. Brady. Then.
Because if you remember when McCarry was there, I think Fergus McCann made a comment that it was like a bus shelter because you bought these guys. I can still remember Ashley
Graham,
Peter Henderson, and yeah, he'd maybe brought three or four of his own guys. I can't remember all their names. But then again, you still had the likes of Brian Scott, your dad, Jimmy Steele, and there was so many of them in there that McCarry had that. And I remember at the time there was a few of that felt a wee bit aggrieved that the likes of Jimmy Steele and Neely, who'd been great servants, were getting put to the side really for guys that didn't know what Celtic meant.
I don't think so much they were put to the side, but I mean. No, because we Lou would still, he would ask my dad, my dad was always there for any of them who come in, and I'm sure, I think he was leaned on a few times probably over the years with boy different managers, and he was there quite happy, but he was never one for wanting to make it known that he was maybe contributing whatever he was contributing. For what I could see, that's not to say that was the case, but that's what it looked like. A lot of times he'd maybe ask my dad for advice, quite rightly. He'd been there that long anyway, he'd probably who the right one had done.
Mm-hmm. And then sadly your dad passed away in 1994, by which time Tommy Burns had took over, so that was another manager.
That's right, he had actually, we played Falkirk just not long before my dad died.
That was the first league game of the season.
Was it? Mm-hmm. And the team coming up to the hospital. I think my dad might have been in the summer, during the summer, because it was quite, between my dad going to the hospital and dying, it was a very short period of time. So I think possibly my dad may have been in a couple of times when Tom, I'm not 100% sure that whether when Tommy first started, no? Mm-hmm. But then, like I say, a very short period of time and he passed away, unfortunately.
One of the greatest tributes to your dad was the fact that Celtic's fitness under Jock Stein during the great years was absolutely exceptional, and everything that I've read and people I've spoken to say that the majority of that was down to your dad in training.
I've heard it said, or again, you're asking me, I'm really the one coming the same as you. I'm only can only tell you what people have told me, same way, or what you've read as well. Man. Seemingly had them. They used to do an awful lot of ball where before.
Yeah,
yeah. It was never the balls. Never used to. Mm. He used to run on the track. Mm. Always run on the track until the drop. But then, and it was just the balls. And made it. They went into the training and they were looking forward to it, as opposed to it being a chore. I mean, it's something they enjoyed, the training. Then it naturally looked after itself.
And many of them still recall that the bracing walks and the Seamall Beach.
That's right.
You know, Neely was a great one, and for getting a bit of fresh air and getting the legs moving and just having a stroll, brisk stroll after their dinner.
I used to take them around as well. I've seen some cracking photographs actually recently, and they're on, looks like sand dunes. There must be dunes in there, but yeah, I'm sure he must have taken them a few runs down there as well.
Mm-hmm. But certainly, when you look at the Inter Milan Cup final in 1967. Celtic's fitness levels were absolutely magnificent.
Aye.
You know, the big guys
again, the heat. I mean, they're there, obviously, but it certainly it looked like it was a fair amount of heat. But and it's really surprising how you see that the second goal goes in. That's it. They've chucked it.
Oh,
they're still there. It's not the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at them; they just walk. They're dejected.
They're dead.
That's it. We've lost it. Mm-hmm. You know, not what you think. Like, get ourselves up here and we'll get this equaliser. Mm-hmm. I think they knew there was not a chance. Mm-hmm.
They were obviously hanging on for extra time, maybe, and at best a replay.
Yeah. But you would think still with 6 minutes to go, you'd have one or two of them maybe getting to jail, but not every single one of them, head down, dejected, that's it, the game's a bogey.
So if Lisbon was the pinnacle, then obviously the Feyenoord is a final. I often compare it in my house when I was growing up. Lisbon was like a happy occasion in the family, like a family wedding, everybody wanted to talk about, but Feyenoord was like some sordid secret that nobody ever mentioned.
I was talking about this last week.
I remember being 5 or 6 and saying about that.
This is
final we were in.
This is if it didn't happen. I must have been probably in my 20s before I realised that it was held in the San Siro.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I presumed it must have been in Belgium or something. It was almost because it was never spoken about.
The other thing as well is that I was in my 20s before I saw the footage. I saw Tommy Gemmell's goal. Uh-huh. I hadn't saw the two Feyenoord goals. And when I saw the Feyenoord goals, I said to myself, oh my God, imagine losing two goals like that in a European Cup final. They were poor goals.
You've seen two goals, I think. I might have seen one of them, but it's almost like I'm in the camp that I've never seen any footage. I mean, it was a real disappointment. So I've never seen any footage from the Feyenoord game,
mm-hmm.
and I've never seen a part of it. You could maybe see a TV programme, they'll show you Henrik's goals, that's fine,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly wouldn't sit down. I'm not in I couldn't do it. I was distraught.
I remember getting this book when I was younger that showed you European Cup winners, and it would say Celtic 67, Man United 68, AC Milan 69 against the 70, and it says Feyenoord 2, Celtic 1. I remember saying to my dad, you never speak about that, my dad. When we go to the final, he's like, shh. And he talked about that because nobody wants to discuss it.
It's incredible when you can get the European Cup final and there's so little written about it. Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a forgotten passage in time. You know, did they ever mention anything about Milan in 70? Obviously, he's trying to forget about it.
Well, possibly. And I obviously wouldn't want to ask about a cup that we lost. And why would I even want to? I mean, again, I'm only 5, 6 year old. No, I mean, so it's not really anything I really comprehended at the time. Mm-hmm. It's only when you look back.
Yeah, yeah.
You think that's a European Cup final we were in. But nobody spoke about that for the last 20 years or whatever. It's almost like I say, it was as if it didn't happen.
It's a bit surreal when you think about it.
There you go.
So there's two stories I'd like to raise with you about your dad. I don't know if you've heard them before, but they're worth commenting for people who are listening on the site. The two fairly funny stories. One in particular is quite amusing. It was round about the early 1990s, and the Celtic team were on the pitch getting their pre-season photograph taken. You know, when you've got the three rows, you've got the guy standing on the bench, guy standing, guy sitting. Mm-hmm. So you maybe get 25 of the team, and unfortunately, in the days, there wasn't any trophies. Liam Brady might be the manager.
And they might bring the Coronation Cup.
Well, that's the thing. And I know somebody who was working in Celtic Park at that time, and he noticed that your dad was standing behind the cameraman, and he thought, that's a bit strange. Nearly mocking, you know, he should have been there with the team.
He used to say, you want in the photograph, Neil? I think I know where you're going to come here.
And he says, Neil, you know, you're going to get your photograph taken. And he winked and he says to this guy, I only get my photo taken in good teams. And I don't believe for a minute that he was being condescending to the current team. It was a bit an element of humour in it as well. But it gave you an idea of his sense of humour.
So many, of course. There's so many line-ups, like pre-season. So mm-hmm. He couldn't have been them all. But I would believe he would say that with a smile.
Now, the other story that I recall reading in a book, it was Jack Charlton's testimonial in 1973, and the Celtic bench was fairly close to the in those days the bench was right next to the enclosure at these football grounds, right on the
in Leeds.
Not just Leeds, but I mean in any football ground in those days, the bench was right against the fans, and your dad came out and there was full of Leeds fans at this part of the enclosure, but one wee boy was there with a big Celtic tammy and a big Celtic scarf, and your dad leaned in and said to him, you alright son, a Celtic fan? And the wee boy says, well, my dad's from Scotland. He says, but we're living in Yorkshire now. He says, but we're big Celtic fans. And your dad lifted him out the enclosure and sat him on the dugout for the duration of the game. And this boy was recalling that in that book, and he was only maybe 7 or 8 at the time, and he never ever forgot that. It was the biggest thrill of his life. And it was a great gesture for your dad to do such a thing for a wee boy.
I thought I'd heard them all. There
off the top of my head, I think it's in John Quinn's Jungle Tales book, which is maybe about 20-year-old now, must ring. Look that up to confirm it, but it's definitely in a Celtic book, and it's definitely your dad, because this wee boy was describing it to a tee, mm-hmm. what it was like, you know, the excitement, and you know, like at the time it's a big game, you know, and Leeds were Celtic had a great affiliation with Leeds in the 80s. We played them quite a few times, friendly games and testimonials and European Cup ties. And Don Ravey and Jock Steen would have been great friends at that period. So I think it was a wee bond between the teams.
The Leeds team was littered with Celtic sports.
It was. We think Eddie Gray, Frankie Gray, Joe Jordan, Billy Bremner. Fantastic at that point. So one thing I was wondering about there, just to ask you, was when did your dad go from being trainer to the kit man? Was there a time that it was maybe too old for the physical side?
No, Scotty came in. My dad, obviously for years, my dad was the man running the park, But then Scotty came in. Big Billy,
78, Brian Scott came in.
He might come from Aberdeen. So then you're talking about that time. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was a door slam break that's going to stop. It was a natural progression that he'd done that. So then my dad.
Scotty was a real medical man.
Aye. Well, he was a physio. So then he took over that man. I couldn't tell you which year that was. My dad still done the pre rubs. No, mm-hmm. him, Steely. Mm-hmm. Steely, brilliant man. Steely, he'd have cracking jokes all the time. So Steely was a fantastic character for everybody. So with that, my dad was still involved. And the preparation and whatever, but eventually, at one stage, Scotty Taylor, the man had gone on to the park. But then, officially, I think he might have, for whatever reason, it may have been about 90 or 91 when I heard that title first, kit manager. Mm-hmm. I might have laughed and think kit manager. In fact, he used to laugh about it, kit manager. No, it was a title that I guess he had to have to put against some books somewhere. Like I say, that's when there was change even then.
Again, when Brian Scott came, there wasn't a lot of newspaper coverage in the days to the degree that you get these days. And I remember one of the first games that a Celtic player got injured, and Brian Scott ran in the park. I remember he had a fancy sort of case thing that your dad would need, because Brian was obviously a qualified physiotherapist, you know.
My dad ran on the park one time, right in front of the dugout, and I'm sure it was a Glasgow derby, but it was right smack bang in front of the dugout. Somebody's got rattled off the park. Mm-hmm. My dad right at the dugout, across in it, and he's got the sponge out, and he's got the leg, and he said, "Who's that?" And then remained silent. Who it was? He said, "Neil, that's not the." It's the other foot. He says, "Well, it might be the other foot and leg, but that's the one you're getting fixed, because I'm not going to look the mug fixing the wrong foot." Pat in the back, he says, "Right, back when you go." So he was actually, he went around and fixed the wrong freaking leg.
So the thing about Brian Scott running this case is, I seriously can remember my Danny's pals going, "Who's that running on there? That's Neely's job." Right, after all the years your dad doing it, it really took a while. Brian Scott, I'm not saying they resented Brian Scott, but the fact that it wasn't your dad that he seemed quite right, and they were a wee bit like, what is he doing? He shouldn't be doing that, because that's Daly's job. He's done it for about 15 years, so therefore he should be doing it for here ever after. So that brings us on now to the collection of memorabilia you've got to your dad. I have to say, it's absolutely astounding. And before I get any further, and there's people jealous out there that I've got the privilege of seeing this stuff, if you go into Google and you Google Neely Mauchin Celtic gravesite, there's fantastic photographs for guys that have been here before and have seen what you've got here. It's absolutely sensational. I mean, your dad was such a successful player. Seeing his medals would have been enough, but I think that there's something about the old jerseys for my generation that it just brings back so many memories, and that there's a simplicity to these jerseys and a class that you don't get in the current things that you get now with advertising and all the fancy paraphernalia that you get these days. And I'm looking across at them here, and I find it hard to describe. There's Fiorentina, Coca-Cola, Turku, Leeds United ones an absolute cracker, there's Sunderland for a friendly. There's all sorts, and that's not even before looking over at the left there and seeing every single Celtic jersey that you can imagine for 1960 probably to about 1995.
Yeah, pre-60 when my dad's jerseys are there as well. So.
And for the 50s, you're absolutely right. And there's a whole collection of the away strips as well. I mean, any Celtic strip that you recall, there's white ones, yellow ones, striped ones, lime green ones, black ones. There's all sorts there. And, you know, it's such an impressive collection that again, we were discussing it beforehand. It would be wonderful if this new museum that the club are getting, that it would give you a space to show this stuff. It is absolutely sensational.
Well, the new museum, depends when that museum comes about. I don't see that. I personally don't see that happening anytime soon. I think we'll be... I mean, people are talking about the next tour. That's not going to happen. That's not even going to happen. There's decades. The way I read it anyway, I would be very surprised if there's a museum up and going before that.
But very disappointed, because there's... talking to
but that's beside the point. 100%. If there was a facility that would show, because ultimately, what can I do? I can only pass on to my lad, you know, and he's seen them. I mean, there's only so much you can do. I mean, I could put them in the walls, but walls aren't big enough. I mean, they do need to be displayed, and I'd be happy enough to display. They've got a couple of things of my dad's in there already.
See, the problem with Celtic Park is that they've got the wee sort of like museum tour that you get at the moment, but they've got certain things in glass frames. And it's nice to look about, but I think a club like Celtic should have a bona fide museum on the premise, adjacent to the premises of the park, and have it big enough that it's an all-day experience. Maybe not all-day, but certainly half-day. You know, something that you can go about and you can see footage, you can look at stuff,
read stuff. Well, they've got that already. They've got a bit in the tour where there's a bit of footage. I've not done the tour for a while.
Yeah, you're right.
But I know what you're saying. If they had a separate entity where
you... You know how when you go to the Glasgow Art Galleries, that you get these touch things?
That's right.
And you can look at a computer and have a touch screen thing and see different players. Now, something like that, I mean, this stuff here would be such a big draw to get people in. It's honestly...
See, I'm lucky in respect, obviously, when I was... for some whatever reason when I was young boy, I used to say get my strip done, because you remember back in the late 60s, now maybe about 70, early 70s, you didn't really change strips.
No, that wasn't
a thing that was done. I mean, the
same strip for about 5 years.
That's right.
The colour would change, maybe,
but certainly wouldn't be changing strips after every European game. But he managed to pick up. Hadn't been in the position, he would maybe give him one of the old ones, because as long as he's seen the hoops, the opposition, they would think it was a strip, so then he'd get one. So that's how how he worked it. He would be able to give it one he had in reserve,
in exchange,
and they would get one back. So that's how basically it accumulated, I think. And we've been at a time when not a lot of people, even players, want to think about in that respect, changes, keep a jersey. Now it's 10 a penny. I seen one a couple of weeks ago, there was guys changing at half time coming to the park. I was absolutely astonished.
That was ridiculous down in England.
I thought it was maybe a Champions League. It didn't matter where it was. How can you be changing the strip coming on? Anyway, so back then, it wasn't that common to be changing strips. So luckily, it was a time when we should get a strip, and he would bring a strip.
Well, your dad was obviously in charge of the Celtic kit at the time and arranging it and getting it sorted. But Willie McStay, I've heard him tell a story that the 4-2 game against Rangers in 79, him and Charlie Nicholas, and I think the other one was John Halton, managed to steal 3 Celtic strips.
A bit puffer.
For underneath the nose of your dad, which apparently was an achievement, because your dad was pretty clued up in these kind of things, and it was hard to get one over them. And they went into the jungle with actual Celtic slips now. People might not think that's anything notable, but you have to remember, 1979, you didn't have the same degree of replica slips. A lot of men even went wearing scarves in the days.
That's right.
So my dad never wore a scarf all his life. You know, it was enough for him to come to the game.
As I say, I don't wear colours. No. I think it started when I was pretty young, maybe once or twice I did, and by coincidence we got beat. And that was it, I had it in my head. I wore a scarf last week, we got beat. I never had my scarf on the week before we won. So to this day.
They would have stood out in the jungle with these jerseys. That was the point they were making, because guys would have went like, where'd they get them for? They look like the bona fide jersey at the time. So,
but even a hoop, were they even produced as to be bought?
I mean, but they were, because the reason I know is we won the league in 79, and it was around about my 13th birthday. And I remember my dad taking up the Celtic shop in West Nile Street, if you recall, where the pools office was. And they had a wee tiny shop behind there that didn't sell much. It sold a few books maybe, and a few things like lighters and things and pens. But they did sell Celtic strips. And I remember for years and years I wanted a Celtic strip, and my ma used to put her foot down and say no, because you'll get into trouble. And eventually when I get into secondary school, my dad went like, well, you can get it, but you only wear it playing football, you don't get to wear it about the streets and things like that. And I actually wish I'd kept it now, because it was a cracker. So, but that was Charlie Nicholas and Willie McStain at the 4-2 game. So the last thing that we have to mention here is Paul Dykes, who's a good friend of the Celtic Underground site, is currently researching a book into your dad's life. Now, this is a good thing, because that Sean Fallon's book, which Stephen Sullivan has had such a good review over the last 6 months. It's a fantastic read, and I'm very hopeful that Paul is going to put something together in a similar vein about your dad and let us know the real story about Neil Walker.
Well, I've met Paul two or three times, and I'm pretty sure he'll make a good job. Whatever he does, he'll make a good job, because when initially when he says he wants to do a book of your dad, obviously I just think a book about my dad. How can that work? No, my dad's not really done anything. But then he pointed out, like if you start 50, well, especially well, my dad, you go further back, Donny Pace, then Morton, then Middlesbrough, then Celtic. But even just for the Celtic point of view, it was Cornish and Cup, then double winners, 7-1. Then you've got Niners. So then, and I said, well, fair enough, you maybe got a point. You may have something to go on. But what I did say, and I dare say, well, over, I think it's this year he's going to be doing it. So most people I meet, ex players and that, I've usually got the first thing I'll say, oh, I remind the time your dad, or I remind the time this. So they've all got a Neely story. Most people have got a Neely story. And
well, add two of them.
I'll speak to Joe Miller actually just. Was it yesterday? Anyway, he was telling me the time they were away someplace, and my dad was an offer. He's a wind-up merchant. As simple as that. And he put all the boots out, and everybody was getting ready. And he says to me, Joe, and Joe's laughing at me. He was laughing today. He wasn't laughing at the time. He's like, oh, nearly. I've got two right feet. You've got all my boots. I've got two right feet. And he was obviously maybe a bit concerned. Oh God, they've only got two. He says, you're joking, let me see. He said, give me them, I'll get something, sorry. So he my dad took the boots away. And before Joe told me the punchline, I knew what he was going to say. He says, a couple of minutes later, but dad come back. He says, right wee man, there you go. And he picked the two left feet. So he took the two right feet away and come back with two left feet. But that broke, again, me Joe was laughing his head off. He says, my dad was, and you could hear him at the back of the tent, hee-hawing and laughing.
There was a photograph in Kerry Dale Street again, I think, recently, and it was one I hadn't seen before, and it was your dad carrying a stretcher out of Ibrox.
That's probably one of the things I remember. I mean, I was quite young then, but I remember that's definitely affected him a bit. He stayed on, brought a lot of bodies out, he definitely mentioned that a couple of times, and I mean, you think that's definitely not a lot of things you wouldn't show much, but no, if things bothered him, but that. There's definitely that.
You can never forget something.
You're taking out young boys now. I'm sure they mentioned that. I know young boys coming out, putting them on the park and laying them out. I mean, I don't know how many would have pulled it, but he was taking them out of stretchers, then even taking them out the ground into the ambulances and that. So that was a terrible time. But I do remember, even though I was young, that is something that sticks in my mind.
My mind as well, from the point of view, we stayed in Govan, which was near Forfibrooks, and my dad wasn't a great drinker. But because it was a foggy day, after the game he'd went for a pint with my Uncle Jim, and they were totally oblivious to anything that happened. And again, younger kids and fans these days won't appreciate the fact that You didn't have Sky Telly, you didn't have mobile phones, you didn't have this access to information. And the news actually came out very, very slowly. And it only came through maybe like the television, and first of it was four dead, eight dead, 12 dead, and it sounds awful to say it, but people at the beginning thought it was fine, because it wasn't clear how these people had died. It was everything coming out, there was nothing coming out that was solid information, it was just very vague. And I can remember standing at the close with my mum and my auntie Annie, his uncle Jim, and my dad came down the street, and my dad got a fright because when he saw them there, they thought there was something up the house, and she was that relieved to see him, that he was okay. And there was a wee woman up the stairs, and she actually came for Fife, and she was a spinster. And we were the only family up the close at a phone. Uh-huh. And about an hour later, she chapped the door, and she was terrified that her son might have been in it. And she managed to phone her son and talk to him, and it made her really assured. And I remember my dad poured her a wee whiskey to make sure that her nerves were all right. And my dad always used to say, God forbid if that woman's son had died, what would we have done with her? You know what I mean? Because like, you couldn't just send her up the stairs a bit off.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it'd have been devastating.
That was a dark day, that one. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I like I say, that there's not a lot of things stick for that thing, but that only because it did affect them. Johnny Doyle, that's another one I remember him.
Ah, John.
When the news comes out with Johnny Doyle, there's another one that thought that stuck in my mind. No, in the house, there'd been a... Not an atmosphere. I had an atmosphere. Again, I was pretty young, but I was aware of.
I remember going to school when Johnny Doyle died, and everybody was gutted. The teachers, everybody. You know, it was hard to comprehend how somebody so young could pass away in just a freak accident in his loft. And Doyle must have been a character.
My dad obviously liked him. Mm. See, again, I'm still pretty young then, but I knew who my dad really liked. I don't think he'd really dislike that many. There was two or three that are the years that I'm sure he influenced their exit, shall we say. But they're very few and far between. I mean, it got on with most people. And saying that, I would probably be the last person to find out if any of the players didn't like him, because they're hardly going to come tell me, oh, by the way, I don't like your old man. But I think most people liked him, because, like I say, he's a wind-up merchant. And the thing about him, his wind-ups, he'd only wind up people who liked. No, if he didn't like somebody, he wouldn't be trying to make fun. I mean, like Machiavelli, him and Mike, he'd gone great with Machiavelli as well. In fact, they arranged one time, Big Billy was always, Mark used to get fined all the time for being late training Monday. But on the QT, my dad and Mark had got the strip and everything, and smuggled the strip out and gave it to, I think it might have been the boy for Clyde who done the weather in the helicopter. Anyway, my dad, Monday morning, Mark is not there. He'd got the train, my dad's in Big Billy's ear. I wasn't there, but he would have been stirring it. No, you've got to get this boy sorted. That's him, you have to get it sorted. And I gave his wine and Big Billy up, and they're just about to start training, say about 10 o'clock, and this chopper's coming. The chopper come down, landed in Barrowfield, who jumped Frank with the full kit on, says, right, big man, we're ready to go. So it was that day. That was obviously a funny thing for everybody that day. And Big Billy's the only one. It wasn't in the know. Everybody else was in the know. Billy.
Well, I know Paul Dykes will do a good job of the book.
Paul's
a great writer.
He's a great guy. I'm confident he will win.
It will come across how much for my dad's generation, your dad, Sean Fallon, and Jock, Big Jock, and the rest of them were worshipped. That's the best word I can use, because they were the happiness and the joy that they gave that generation. And even when I was growing up as a kid, and he was a guy who commanded great respect. So you know, really looking forward to the book.
Likewise.
When that comes out. Now, there's one further thing to say before we go here. You took a lot of coaxing into coming on here.
Aye, right? Absolutely. Because I don't know what I was going to be able to tell you.
You weren't convinced that you were great subject matter for a podcast, but I'm looking here, that's 52 minutes, and it's been by like 2 minutes. So I'd just like to thank you for taking the trouble to talk to us. And there's me and a mate of mine's here, and to see that this treasure trove of stuff you've got is an absolute dream. And again, just to re-advertise, Google Neely Malkin, Celtic gravesite, and there's great photographs up there. Some of the stuff's got to be seen to be believed. And apart from that, thanks very much for your time there.
No problem, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Once again, St Anthony manages to find a guest who gives us a fantastic insight into the history of the club. Hopefully you enjoyed that. There will be more podcasts to come. However, I think you've had quite a few in the last few weeks, so hopefully there's nobody whinging about the volume of output on here. Thanks to St Anthony. I've only done a couple. Thanks to St Anthony. He's managed to get most of these out. So this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night. Good night. It's okay.